Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. We're going to talk about lots of things in the garden, but zeroing in to begin with, at least, to talk with you about controlling insects in your vegetable garden. With us from Washington State, Susan Mulvihill. She's a longtime gardening columnist, a master gardener, author of the blog, YouTube channel, Susan's in the Garden. And we're talking with her about her latest book, The Vegetable Garden Pest Handbook. And we'd love to hear from you. Join in with your garden pest questions or others as well at 1-800-642-1234 or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Susan Mulvihill, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Hi, Larry. Thank you so much for having me on today.
Well, you wrote in your book that knowing how to grow your own food is an important skill. Besides getting great produce, what else does it do in your mind?
Well, yeah, really. I mean, produce is the big thing, of course, and being able to embrace the environment that is out in your garden, you know, looking after the different types of beneficial insects and understanding what exactly you have in your garden, keeping the plants healthy and so on, and trying to have some diversity in the garden, too, is certainly important.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, talk about your book, The Vegetable Garden Pest Handbook.
Sure. So, you know, I had a few goals for this book, and it's something that I've had in my mind for quite a while. I kept thinking gardeners need some type of a guide to the types of insects that are out there. And I'm talking about both the good ones and the bad ones. And, you know, there are a lot of insect sort of encyclopedias, but they don't show you what kind of damage the bugs do in your garden, how to control them, and, you know, you don't get a lot of photos of their different life stages and so on. So I wanted to provide gardeners with a guide to help them identify the types of bugs they encounter in their gardens through lots of photos. There's over 200 of them, and different types of tools that help them narrow down which bugs they've found. So to do that, I provided photos of the different stages of each bug's life cycle, as well as photos of the plant damage they cause. I also created this massive diagnostic chart where you go to the name of the crop you're growing, read through the descriptions of the damage that you might be seeing in your garden, and that will point you to the culprit or other potential culprits that do similar type of damage. There's a profile for each bug, and that includes a description of what they look like, what they do, what their life cycle involves, which vegetable crops they're typically seen on, what their damage looks like, who their natural predators are. And then I provide a list of organic solutions for controlling the pest. In addition, I have a chart on beneficial bugs because there are so many of them out in our gardens, but we often don't recognize them. And so I have descriptions of them along with photos, and you can find out which pests they prey on, how to make them feel welcome in your gardens, and help them help you out in the garden. So I also cover all kinds of organic methods that work for these types of bugs, and there is a DIY section for all kinds of do-it-yourself projects that range from traps and barriers to some fun things like building an insect hotel that attracts beneficial insects, creating a covered raised bed or row cover hoops. So it's a little bit of everything, but it's all about the bugs.
Yeah, it really is, and there's some great photos in your book. The photography in it is great. You can really easily identify the bugs that you're talking about, and the beneficials Remember you told a story in the book, and I can't remember what the bug was, but it was something that you were going to come back to and take care of. You found in your garden, and then when you tell that story, it's a pretty cool story.
Sure, and it's a good lesson for all of us. So my husband and I grow cherry currants in our garden. And it was probably about this time of year, we were walking around the yard, and we saw, we walked up to the currant bushes, and I saw puckered leaves, and I thought, oh, aphids, darn it, you know, because they're just so awful. And so I turned over a leaf, and sure enough, there were hundreds, if not thousands of them. And at the time, I had something else going on, and I thought, I'm going to come back out here and, you know, maybe try hosing them off the plants or whatever. And I just got busy. I completely forgot about the aphids, if you can believe that. for a few days, I walked back out there. I suddenly thought, oh, no, the aphids. I'm picturing that my poor plants have been, you know, totally destroyed. And what I saw on all the leaves were either ladybugs or ladybug larvae, which looked kind of like little orange and black crocodiles. And they were having a field day with those aphids. I could not find a single live aphid on the bushes. And what the lesson it taught me, and this won't hold true for all types of vegetable garden pests, I readily admit that, but a lot of times, if we can be a little bit patient, the beneficial insects will help us out in our gardens and help control those nasty pests.
Yeah, Deb, it was a great story. I really had to smile when I read that. I have unfortunately not had the same success with it all the time, but it does point to the importance of beneficial insects and knowing which ones are beneficial and which ones aren't.
Exactly. And, you know, there was another time I walked out in my garden last year and I saw this movement on one of the floating row covers over, I think it was my broccoli crop. And I thought, holy cow, what is that? And it was bug is in the book. It's a snake fly. And I don't believe you get them over there. I think it's more of a Western U.S. Insect, but it's related to lace wings. But it has this very long kind of menacing-looking head and neck. And so, you know, if I had gone by my gut reaction where I thought, oh, my gosh, this looks like a bad bug, so I better kill it, I would have been doing myself a disfavor because they prey on aphids and spider mites. They eat insect eggs. And so it was actually a beneficial. And what happened is I took a photo of it with my phone, and then I went inside and I did a web search that said insect with really long neck. And it's amazing how sometimes you can do a web search that you can just nail the identification right off the bat. And boom, there was this snake fly picture looking at me on my computer. And so I read about it, and I thought, oh, these are really cool. And so I started looking for them out in the garden. I had more of them than I realized. I had never noticed them before. But when you're writing a book about bugs, you sort of have this heightened awareness of everything that moves in your yard. But it is so important, and I really emphasize this in the book, that you need to identify what the bug is that you're wondering about before you make any decisions about its fate, because more times than not, it's going to be a beneficial insect.
Susan Mulvihill, our guest today, a longtime gardening columnist, a master gardener, and her latest book is The Vegetable Garden Pest Handbook, Identify and Solve Common Pest Problems on Edible Plants. Join in with your questions or comments. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. talk a lot about organics, obviously. Why are you an organic gardener? And what does that actually mean?
Yeah, exactly. It means a couple of things. One is gardening without the use of synthetic chemicals, whether it's for pest control or fertilizers or herbicides. And the other thing that it also involves is taking good care of your soil. And by doing that, your soil will in turn benefit the plants that you're growing. So that's the general term for organic gardening. And, you know, in the book, I talk about the negative impacts that synthetic chemicals and pesticides have in our gardens. You know, for so long, they've been billed as this easy fix. So you have a bug that's bothering you, you spray it, and you kill it. But the problem is they're generally non-selective, and that means, sure, they'll kill that pest that you're trying to get rid of, but it will also kill their predators. And so that is definitely not a good thing. Also, some types of chemicals are harmful to the pollinators, and if we kill off our pollinators, we're going to be in a world of hurt. And it also, some of the products out there will also kill other types of creatures, sometimes like aquatic, you know, fish, other types of aquatic creatures. And then also something I learned from researching for this book is that there are certain insects that are horrible ones that have developed a resistance to pesticides. And thinking of like spider mites and Colorado potato beetles, for example. And that is a great reason to go with organic methods. And then, of course, I worry about the residue of whatever this product is on the produce that I've grown.
Sure.
So is it still safe to eat? But the main thing is I'm trying to share the importance of embracing the environment that surrounds us through observation, through education, and avoiding the use of chemicals.
Let's take some calls. Linda in Cedarburg, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Linda.
Hi.
Hi, what's on your mind? Me? Yes.
My mind is bothered by Japanese beetles. They're all over in Wisconsin now. Is there an organic way to control them?
Organic way to control Japanese beetles. What do you think, Linda? Go ahead. I'm sorry, Susan. Go ahead.
Yeah, no problem at all. So, Linda, I really feel for you because they are awful creatures. And so far, I shouldn't say this, but we don't have them in Washington State. Thank heavens. But I know that with climate change, probably eventually we will. But there's a few things about Japanese beetles that you need to know and that also should help with controlling them. Certainly one thing is to be diligent about hand-picking the beetles early on to curb their population levels. And I do understand that they kind of scurry when they see you coming, but you can give that a shot. And the reason that's important is because it will cut down on the amount of plant damage you get. And when plants are damaged, there are chemicals released from the plant, which attract even more Japanese beetles, which is not good. Another thing is, don't mow your lawn as frequently because, you know, the grubs where they develop is in turf grass. And so if you keep it at a higher length, the lawn, that will make it more able to tolerate less watering. And so the less appealing that the conditions are in the turf, below it for those grubs, the better. There is a product that I learned about while researching for this book. I don't know if you've heard of Bacillus thuringiensis. Have you heard of that?
Oh, yes.
Linda?
Yes, I have.
Okay. So there is a strain of it that is called Galleriae, G-A-L-L-E-R-I-A-E. And it is, so it's a natural bacteria that is safe for humans, but it helps control both the adults and the grubs, which I think is great because a lot of times there hasn't been much of a control that's helpful against the beetles. And then I know this is hard, but if you can cut back on the frequency of when you water your lawn, that makes it really tough on the grubs. I know that's hard. And then the most important thing with Japanese beetles, do not use Japanese beetle traps. I know a lot of people swear by them, and they say, well, I catch all of these beetles. But the problem is that research has found that the lures they use in those traps actually attract more beetles to your area. So I know that's a controversial topic, but I've seen it time and time again in research. So I hope that
Linda, helps. Yeah, Linda, I hope that helps. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or if you'd prefer, you could send us an email to ideas@WPR.org. Susan Mulvihill, our guest, and her latest book is The Vegetable Garden Pest Handbook. Tyler Ditter, our engineer today, Jill Nadeau, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Susan Mulvihill. Her latest book, The Vegetable Garden Pest Handbook, Identify and Solve Common Pest Problems on Edible Plants. And again, you can join us 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@WPR.org. Let's turn to Dan in Lone Rock next. Dan, hi. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, thanks. I have a question about squash borer, but first I just wanted to say thank you for having this guest, Larry, and addressing the organic stuff, and thank you very much for sharing your knowledge with us. It's really important to us for just not just for our own health and safety, but for our communities and all those chemicals get made somewhere too. People got to work in those factories and live in those communities. So really appreciate looking for our earth for all of these alternative options. But my question's about squash borer, and it's something that we've had in our garden for years, and I've tried the technique of kind of cutting into the vine and trying to root out the bugs is the only one that I really know of, and it sometimes it seems like it works and sometimes it doesn't. I'm just wondering if you've got other ideas.
All right, okay, Dan, thanks.
Yeah, so squash vine borers are another atrocious insect. The adult is a red and black moth that's actually, it's quite a pretty moth, and it's active during the day, which is unusual. What the adult does is they lay eggs at, just individual eggs, at the base of their host plant. So things like pumpkins, summer and winter squash. That's the main thing that you'll see them on. And so after each individual egg hatches, the larvae start boring into the stems. And this is another insect that I have not had to deal with in my garden. And however, while researching this, I thought, oh my gosh, this is awful. So there are a few things you can do. One is considering planting a what's called a trap crop of squash either you can do it away from where you're going to plant, or it's just an early planting of the squash. And when you see it has been, I don't want to say infected, but it has the, you can
attack,
tell
maybe.
Yes, thank you. That word was escaping me. You know, you're going to see yellowing leaves, wilting plants, and sometimes you'll be able to see the puncture holes in the stems. And it sounds like Dan is familiar with that really well. So what I was going to say is you can consider planting a trap crop and then pulling that. I know it sounds crazy, but pulling the plant up to dispose of it, which will eliminate both potentially the eggs and the larva. And then you have tried the method of cutting into the stem where you can tell there is a larva. And once you have made that cut and gotten the larva out of there, you have to immediately cover the area either with soil or some type of tape so that the plant can heal. But the other thing that is interesting is to keep the moths from laying eggs, you can wrap the lowest section of each plant's main stem with like a little collar of aluminum foil. And every now and then check it and adjust it as necessary, you know, as the plant grows. But it's eliminating that spot where the moths will lay the egg, and then the egg in turn hatches and bores into the stem. So if that's something you haven't tried yet, I'd recommend that. And then one other thought I had was, I don't know if you've ever tried beneficial nematodes, but there are two species of them. You can purchase them online, and you can inject the nematodes into the vines to kill, you know, the nematodes will kill the larva. And then the other idea I have, and you might not like it very much, but if you've been having them year after year after year, you might consider not growing the cucurbit family. So again, pumpkins, summer and winter squash, and so on, for a year or two to break the cycle. I mean, sometimes we gardeners just get desperate. So that is another option for you.
Dan, I hope that helps. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too. Number to call 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. You talk about attracting the good bugs to your garden, Susan. How do you attract the good bugs?
Well, certainly the number one thing would be to avoid using pesticides, like we talked about earlier. Another thing you can do is to really focus on planting a diverse landscape, especially all different kinds of flowers. And I don't know too many gardeners who would object to that. And that's because the different types of beneficial insects have different types of mouth parts. And usually, at least one stage of their life, they need to have nectar and pollen. And so if you plant all different kinds of flowers, there will be a type of flower head that they can access the nectar or pollen in. So that would be good. Don't clean up underneath your shrubs at the end of the season, because if you have some leaf litter down there, that's a place for the beneficials to overwinter in. And then one of the fun DIY projects in the book is to build your own insect hotel. And that attracts beneficial bugs that will either use it to hibernate in during the winter or to lay eggs in so that they can raise young, so you have even more beneficial insects. So that's one of the most fun ones, and it's really educational for kids to see, you know, these insects up close.
So talk about, describe what you've got with an insect hotel.
Okay, so it's the main thing with them is that they can be any size or shape that you want. It's basically a structure, and it needs to have a roof on it to help protect the inhabitants from rain and snow. It needs to face either south or east, so it takes advantage of that early morning sun. And basically, you have a lot of little sort of like cubby holes in it that you might have filled with, the tubes, the hollow tubes you can purchase at garden centers, or bamboo, straw, the flower stems of scent flowers that also have tubes. So a lot of times you get native solitary bees nesting in there, which is one of my goals, because then you get more, more pollinators in your garden, which is important. You might drill holes into small, short logs. There's a lot of things you can use, cardboard rolled up, burlap, pine cones, different things that will provide an attractive area for these bugs to go into to, again, either hibernate or lay eggs.
Yeah, it's pretty cool idea there. Well, you can join in. Again, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us, send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you as we visit with Susan Mulvihill. And we can take other gardening questions as well, vegetable gardening questions, I should say, as well. Not necessarily only vegetable garden pests, but there are plenty of pests to talk about for sure in the book. And as I look through your book, there are a couple of insects that we don't typically have here, but they're almost every one that you've got in here is something that raises heck with our plants here.
Yes.
that was one of the attractive things about it from my perspective. Talk about the Colorado potato beetle. That's one that is a problem every year here in Wisconsin. And I'm wondering what you recommend in terms of controlling that particular insect.
Okay. So, this is that one of them that I mentioned earlier that is resistant to pesticides, so very good reason to go with organic methods. So there's an adult beetle. Once they mate, the female lays eggs. They hatch into these rather plump larvae, and they are mainly seen on potato plants, but also other plants in the nightshade family, so eggplants, peppers, tomatillos, tomatoes, and also weeds that are within the nightshade family. And so that is one of the controls. If you have, you have to know your weeds, but if you have weeds in that family, it's very important to keep up with pulling them out of your garden. So one thing that's helpful if a person's garden allows for this is to use a 3-year crop rotation, because the adults overwinter in the soil, and so you don't want them to make it really easy for them to find your crop every single year. Also, you might consider pre-sprouting your seed potatoes before you plant them, if it's potatoes that they are specifically bothering in your garden. And that way, they get kind of a running start when you plant them, and then they're more able to withstand damage from the beetles. And it's actually the beetles and the larvae that are both chewing on the foliage. You also want to do a good job of keeping an eye on the plants, so monitoring your garden on a regular basis. Look on the undersides of leaves to crush, look for those orange eggs, which you would want to crush. Hand-pick the beetles and the larvae. You can also cover the plants with floating row cover for the entire season, because potato plants, they'll occasionally bloom, but they really don't need to be pollinated in order to produce the tubers. There are a couple of organic products you can use that will work against them. One would be applying beneficial nematodes to your soil. You can use a product called kaolin clay that you spray on the leaves. Neem, plant extracts, pyrethrins, or spinosad. But one thing I wanted to mention about those products, just because something is labeled organic, that doesn't necessarily mean they are 100% safe. Because some of them, and I mentioned a few, like the spinosad, pyrethrins, and neem, they are toxic to pollinators. And that means you need to be very careful about the time of day you apply them. You would want to do it really early in the morning before pollinators are active, or very late in the day after they've gone home for the night.
Yeah, all good tips. John in Two Rivers has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, John.
Hi. So I have, I started a bunch of seeds, and I started them too early. But I got excited. I haven't had a garden in a lot of years and retired. And so I started these. Now I've got tomato plants that are about a foot and a half high. And they have these, what people call Chinese ladybugs on them. Do they hurt anything?
Asian lady beetles, yeah, we call them.
Okay, so I am not familiar with them. Do you want to help me out, Larry?
Well, they're another version of ladybugs. They don't do. I don't think they do as damage to the plants as much. But they also don't. They don't attack the. The insects that we want them to attack much either.
Well, that's not fair.
Yeah, it's not fair. Someone else may have a thought on this, but I've never been too worried about them in my own gardening. So, John, do you feel like they're given you problems?
Well, you know, I mean, it's still early. The plants are all still in the house, and, I just was down there the other night looking at them, and they're, I must have picked 15 or 20 of them off the plants. There's still a lot of them. Now, I know they will bite you. They bite like you know, like biting flies that we have. If you get one on and don't knock him off, he'll give you a little bite. But I'm trying to. We have a problem out here in Two Rivers. You know, it's wet all the time, and it's a lot cooler than what it is in the rest of the state. We're 10 degrees cooler today than just like in Appleton. And so we have a problem with aphids and some things like that. And short of buying some ladybugs, I was hoping I could find something that would eat some of these. And we have that scaly thing that gets on plants.
Right. And I did a quick search while we're talking here. From an extension website, and it mentions that they do bother things like apples, and that but they do prey on aphids, but they'll move on to other things if they run out of aphids. So that's not good. And you know, I typically discourage purchasing beneficial insects, you know, from like a garden center or online, for the most part, just because a lot of times you don't know where they came from. Are they not native to your area? Because if they aren't, they could potentially carry a disease that's deadly to the good kinds of, whatever that same insect is. So let's say ladybugs. So I really don't know about that.
John, I was going to say, in terms of your tomato plants, I'm glad you haven't put them in the ground yet, because it's early for it. You're in Two Rivers, which is north of Madison by quite a bit, but even in the southern Wisconsin area, we've got frost warnings tonight for several areas of the southern Wisconsin. And tomatoes, and especially peppers, do not do well if they're out in those kinds of weather. I imagine, Susan, that's been your experience, especially with peppers.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Peppers especially, and tomatoes, if they are subjected to cold, not even just frost, it can stunt their growth and impact how they grow for the whole season. I don't know how tall your plants are, John, but I'm hoping that maybe you can just up-pot them to a larger pot. But the big thing is, if you have some nice days, you probably want to start the hardening out process where, you know, you put them out for about an hour in filtered light the first day, bring them back inside. The second day, 2 hours, bring them back in. Third day, 3 hours. And you're sort of gradually exposing them to more and more intensity of sunlight. And that way, when it is safe for you to start planting your tomatoes there, those plants are ready to go in the garden immediately. So yeah, that might give you something to do in the meantime. And I can't blame you. I get excited too, and I want to plant things early, but I think I've been bitten enough times to slow myself down a little bit.
And it doesn't hurt to kind of run your hand over those plants and
yes,
move them around a little bit to sort of stiffen them up a bit. Susan, you think?
Yes, absolutely. And one of the things that's interesting that I learned recently is that if you accidentally break off, let's say, the main stem of a tomato plant, let's say it falls over or you have a windstorm come up or something, you can take that broken piece and put it in a glass of water and it will root very quickly and it's like it doesn't miss a beat. So in case that happens, you can do that too.
Yeah. John, thank you so much. Appreciate your call. Susan Mulvihill, our guest today. Her book is called The Vegetable Garden Pest Handbook. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Susan Mulvihill. She's a longtime gardener, has a column. She's had a garden column for a long time. She's a master gardener. She's the author of the blog Susan's in the Garden, and her latest book is called The Vegetable Garden Pest Handbook. So great to have her with us. Join in with your own questions or comments at 800-642-1234 or email us to ideas@wpr.org. Debbie and Merrill will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Debbie.
Well, hi, how are you?
Good, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I was calling in reference to the gentleman that had the Asian beetles that were falling in love with his tomato plants. And those beetles probably wintered over in his home. They probably found a little corner in a closet or something. And now that the days are brighter and warmer and maybe by a window where those plants are, they're attracted to the light and to those tomato plants. So the best thing to do is to give them an escort to the great outdoors. And you can take the plant itself and go outside and then just flick them off with your finger and then take your tomato plant back inside.
Yeah, not a bad idea. And the other thing I was thinking about after he hung up, but there may have been something on the plants that the Asian lady beetles were interested in eating, which he might want to be checking his plants a little bit just to see if there's not something else there that might create some problems for the plants. But Debbie, good points. Ted and Spooner called to say an old farmer told him years ago that if you plant your potatoes after June 1st, here in Wisconsin, you won't have potato beetles. He's done it for years, and it's worked for him, at least in the Spooner area. So what do you think about the timing, Susan?
You know, if it's working for him, I would say that's a great idea. you know, a lot of times, if you can plant things a little later than usual, a lot of what will happen is you'll miss that peak egg laying time. And so I think that's probably what's happening for him. And if that works, I'd say that's awesome.
Yeah, I as well. Chris and Adams had wondered about, or asked you maybe to speak about the No Mow May efforts. Don't mow your lawn in May to benefit beneficial insects and those that might feed and be looking for nectar in things like dandelions or creeping Charlie.
Yes. So that is a great suggestion. And what I think a lot of people don't realize is that dandelions especially are an early source of nectar and pollen for bees. And I know we all love to have pristine lawns. However, if you can leave them, just leave your lawn alone, you certainly will help out bees. And these days, they need all the help they can get. I've seen folks have signs that say, "Pardon the mess, we're feeding the bees." You know, if you could do something like that, maybe to help your neighbors feel better. But yes, I think that that is a great thing for all of us to remember, is that those dandelions are an early source of food. So they are important. They certainly are on a gardener's least favorite list, but they do play an important role.
Let's take another call. Rita in Spooner. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. My name is Rita.
Yes.
And when my mom always told me that when I'm going to plant my flowers that I or flowers or plants that I've got vegetables that I bought from the nursery, bring them home, but just relax a little bit and plant them in the evening between like 5 and 7 o'clock at night, and then water them and make sure that they're in the ground. And before they could rest all night long before they see the sunshine in the morning. And it creates a better plant. And I've always followed her advice.
Oh, well, that's one I haven't heard. But would Susan comment?
Yes, I think that that is a great idea. Or what I tend to do is I try to, the weather doesn't always cooperate, but what I try to do is to pick a very overcast day. Because when you plant your, let's say your flower seedlings, if it's a warm, bright, sunny day, it's very stressful for them and they'll start wilting. And so if you plant them very late in the day or on a very overcast day, it's way less stress on the plant. So yeah, Rita, I think that was great advice from your mom.
All right. Thanks, Rita. Appreciate that. Oh, man. Veronica emailed to ask if you could talk about growing asparagus. When should she plant and when can she harvest? Can't harvest that first year, I don't think. But
no. No, and I think that growing asparagus really tries a gardener's patience, but it is worth it in the end. So, usually what most folks do is they buy what are called asparagus crowns. They look like these big, leggy plants. It's really hard to explain. They look like
roots,
basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
And some folks will start their asparagus from seed, but generally speaking, most folks will buy the crowns. You can find them very easily at garden centers and online. And springtime is the time to get them started. And generally the method is you dig yourself either like a trench or a hole for each one. You sort of fan out those roots in, you know, into the planting hole or trench and fill in some soil just around those roots rather than right at the crown of each one. And as the plants grow that first year, you are filling in that trench or hole around each asparagus crown and watering them well, of course. And you cannot, or should not, I should say, harvest asparagus spears that first year. The second year, you can maybe harvest a few asparagus spears in a very short period of time, because the whole goal is, since these are a perennial vegetable that will come back year after year after year, you want to give them the chance to establish themselves. And so that third year, you can harvest them for a longer period of time. But you always want to leave some spears on the plants because they are going to turn into ferns. And the more foliage there is on a plant, the more it can conduct photosynthesis, which in turn will feed the plants. So, you have to be patient for the first couple of years, and then you can start getting into more of a regular harvest.
Good points. Let's go to Amy in Door County. Hi, Amy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm working on a new garden bed this year. I've used it before, but not for a while, so I'm kind of starting from scratch. It's about 10 by 8, and I'm reading all about companion planting and also the idea that some plants should not be planted near each other. So what I'm calling about is strawberries and kale. I can't find the information to tell me exactly how far apart should they be from each other in the garden.
Okay, strawberries and kale.
I can address this a little bit. I don't know the specific answer to your question. I think it's more a matter of spacing them appropriately as far as how large each plant is going to get. But the other thing I wanted to mention is, you know, there's been the concept of companion planting for many, many years, and there hasn't been a lot of research behind why certain plants maybe wouldn't grow well next to each other or why some benefit from each other. And so Jessica Walliser wrote a new book called Plant Partners, and it's all research-based because, you know, in each of our gardens, something might do really well just because, you know, the weather was just perfect for it. It got the right amount of water. You know, you gave it a certain amount of fertilizer or something. But there are some plants that either exude a type of natural chemical that either makes plants near it grow better or not grow as well. And there are some plants you can use to support other plants in that kind of a companionship. But I do recommend her book. I hope you don't mind, Larry.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, this Plant Partners is an excellent book, and she talks a lot about the different types of plants that benefit each other, but for scientific reasons, where they could figure out, oh, there's this natural chemical that does this or that. So I do recommend that. But I think if you're wanting to plant kale and strawberries together, I think I would just space them based on how much room they need to grow.
Yeah, yeah. And we've had Jessica on the program in the past, and and her book is really a good book. Thanks for recommending that, Susan. Amy, I thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. John emailed to ask about how to grow microgreens in the house.
Oh, that just happens to be one of my things. So, for those who aren't familiar with microgreens, that's where you're growing some type of edible plants Usually things like brassica family crops, but it could be all different types of things. You could grow basil, and you grow it just so it's usually till it gets its true leaves, and then you harvest them when they're very young. And research has shown that they're up to 40 times more nutritious than the what the mature plant would be, which I think is amazing. And so, yeah, if you have a grow light, John, that's what I would recommend using. And then you would just put a couple of inches of like a germination mix, seed starting mix, into the container. Make sure that it's lightly moist. And then you very thickly plant the seed. And, you know, we gardeners are so used to spacing things appropriately, but it turns out that they can grow very thickly because you're harvesting them while they're really young. But they're very easy to grow. And I do have a video on my YouTube channel.
Susan Mulvihill, our guest. Her book, The Vegetable Garden Pest Handbook. I'm Larry Mealer for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mealer here. My guest, Susan Mulvihill, longtime gardening columnist and a master gardener. Her latest book is called The Vegetable Garden Pest Handbook. So what questions do you have for Susan about your garden? You need some help identifying an insect, maybe a general garden, vegetable gardening question. I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. And I just wanted to mention that Susan was commenting on Jessica Walliser and her book, Plant Partners, and we did have her on the show. Jill reminded me on March 12th of this year. So you could, if you wanted to listen to that, you could just go to ideas@wpr.org/Larry and then just go back to March 12th and you can find that interview that I did with her. So I'd love to have you do that. And if you have a question, I hope you'll join in right now. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Judith in Duluth, Minnesota, just joining us now. Let's go there. Judith, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yes, good morning. My question is about growing vegetables in styrofoam containers. I have a number of styrofoam coolers that were sent to me with food in them over the winter. Uh-huh. And they're piling up in my garage. And what I would like to do is spray paint them, at least on the outside, with some neutral colors, and then plant garden salad-type crops inside of them, because they're, you know, it's about 6 inches of soil there. And I'm wondering if that's safe to do so, and if the vegetables would grab chemicals from the styrofoam that I would rather not eat.
So how big are those those containers, by the way, Judith?
They're about 14 by, I would say, 24.
And they're, you said, about 6 inches in depth?
Maybe 8, looking at the bottom. So it's 8 inches.
Okay. Well, Susan, what do you think?
You know, I have never done that, but I have seen British gardeners on British TV shows using them. So I don't think that it is a problem. The main thing that I don't know is about painting them, if that could somehow go through the styrofoam and into the soil and contaminate the plants. That's the main thing I would be a little concerned about.
Yeah, I would have that same concern. I think since these were, for Judith, these were food delivered, I would think that they would be safe to use, but I'd wonder about the painting myself. So I think that might be something to think about, Judith. But thanks for that call. Appreciate it very much. Let's go to Jennifer in Shorewood, Minnesota. Hi, thank you for calling, Jennifer.
Hi, I live on the shore of Lake Minnetonka, so it's a very wet, moist area. The ground is also a little damp, but I have a raised bed garden. And every year, certain plants seem to be prone to powder mildew. Once the powder mildew sets in, almost instantly the Japanese beetles come. So I'm wondering if there's something I can do to keep both the powder mildew and the Japanese beetles off my plants.
Yeah, that powdery mildew and the arrival of the Japanese beetles, it might not be that the powdery mildew is attracting them, or is it, Susan? I was thinking it might just be a question of the timing of when the beetles happen to get active and then the powdery mildew is active at the same time.
Right. I was actually thinking the same thing, that it might be coincidental. And I talked earlier in the broadcast about different organic ways that you can deal with the Japanese beetles and their the grubs. So I don't know if you want to refer back to that or...
Or maybe just give a quick rundown of what you talked about earlier.
Sure. So there is an organic product called Bacillus thuringiensis. BT is what we typically call it because that's easier. And there is a strain that is called Galleriae. It's Galleriae. And that is... apparently very successful for controlling Japanese beetles and the grubs, which I think is great. Let's see. The other things we talked about was hand picking the beetles very early on, because the more plant damage they do, the more the chemicals that the plants exude attracts even more Japanese beetles. So you would want to try to address that early on if you can. Try to mow your lawn less frequently and water it less frequently, because the grubs are in the soil underneath the turf grass, and you want to make it as inhospitable as possible. And then, let's see, I was thinking there was one other control. Oh, the other thing I mentioned is if you are using a Japanese beetle trap, do not. And that's because research has shown that the attractant that's used in the traps actually attracts more beetles than you would ordinarily get in your yard. So it's very important to not use those to control them.
All right, Jennifer, thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. We get a lot of questions about diatomaceous earth.
Yeah.
How do you use it? If you use it. I think you do.
Yes, I do, actually. I use it for a few interesting things, mostly to protect young plants. So it looks like sort of a flowery substance, but it's actually made from the fossilized remains of diatoms, which are algae, and they are found all over the world. And so they pulverize these diatoms to make this product. And there is a food grade of diatomaceous earth that you can purchase. And so what it does is, even though you can handle it, you don't want to breathe it in, but you can certainly handle it without gloves on. It won't bother your skin as far as cutting it, but it has tiny sharp edges in it that will cut an insect skin. And what happens is it causes the insect to dehydrate and die. And so what I'll do is to keep things like pill bugs, slugs, earwigs, I'm trying to think of what, cutworms, all of these things will not go to a plant if you have sprinkled the diatomaceous earth around the base of the plant, because a lot of times those insects are after those real succulent stems of seedlings. The only downside to diatomaceous earth is once it gets wet, it's not as effective, so you have to reapply it.
All right, there we go. Let's go to Andrea in Madison. Hi, Andrea.
Hi there. I just wanted to say that the person who wanted to use the styrofoam containers, the most important thing probably is to drill some holes in it so that they the plants don't drown. And painting it on the outside probably would be okay. Inside, I wouldn't do it, but the outside. And I wanted to, I'm a pest specialist, and just wanted to give a little bit of more information on the Japanese beetles control, if I may.
Yeah, sure.
It is important, as you said, to pick those Japanese beetles off. And one of the reasons why is that if they stay on a plant and find it to their liking, they'll start putting out a pheromone that, we call it an aggregation pheromone, sort of like party invitations. This is delicious, come on by. They will start accumulating on that plant. I remember Phil Pelletieri had a sacrificial plant that he would allow the Japanese beetles to collect on, and they really will congregate on a single plant. Sometimes you see that with linden trees in a neighborhood. One tree is completely defoliated and everything else is left alone. You do have to pick them off if you can. And if you can't, take note, and if you value a tree, say a linden or a white birch, arrange for it to have a systemic insecticide treatment if you needed to protect it. If it's really healthy, you can let it go for a year of being really tattered in July. But I wouldn't even do that with a white birches in this area, because the temperatures in our summers are just getting too hot for them, and they're a bit under stress to begin with. So yeah, get out there, pick Japanese beetles, and keep them off your plants.
All right, thanks for calling. Any comments Susan?
Well, I just wanted to thank Andrea because that is important to mention the natural, you called it the aggregation or congregation, mm-hmm. aggregation chemical that they release. That is also another good reason to get right in there and try to prevent that from happening.
Yeah. Thanks, Andrea. Appreciate it very much. Jeff in Dousman, your turn. Hi, Jeff.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm on the subject of Japanese beetles. If you were using those traps in a large enough property and kept them away from the gardens where you don't want the Japanese beetle, would that be a strategy that you could use? As long as you don't interfere with your neighbor's gardens, we wouldn't want to start a bug war.
That's a good point. And I have heard some people say, yeah, just put the trap over next to your neighbors and you'll be just fine. all of the information I've read indicates that it is the traps are drawing in more beetles to an area. And I also realize that I do not deal with Japanese beetles here, but I've always heard how horrible they are. So I have no experience in this, but I would say, just based on my research, it's really indicating that the attractant in them is bringing in more beetles than what a person would deal with. I almost would, if you're having problems with them, say, in your vegetable garden, I think I would give that BT galeriae a chance, because I think that sounds very promising.
Yeah. You know, while we're talking about traps, and, you know, that particular trap isn't great, but you have some traps in your book that are good. A couple of them that I noticed, anytime anybody calls and says earwig, they always say earwigs. I found an earwig. And so you've got some photos and some suggestions for how to build an earwig trap.
Yes, and you know, they're very simple. If the one type, because I have three different types to suggest. One, if you have a container that has a lid on it, you would drill some holes in the lid and then sink the container into the soil so that the lip of the container is even with the soil surface. Then you pour in a couple of inches of vegetable oil, and then you put in a splash of soy sauce, which I know sounds crazy, but that scent attracts the ladybugs. And what they do is, of course, they're active at night. You snap the lid on, and they crawl through the holes in the lid, fall into the oil, and they drown.
So there's, you got dead also, earwigs.
Exactly. And we had a horrible time in 2019 with earwigs, and that trap was amazing. You can also take corrugated cardboard, either roll it up or make a little stacks of pieces of corrugated cardboard, put them in problem areas of your garden, and during the daytime they will have hidden in the corrugated cardboard. Or you can take rolls of newspaper, same thing, and then in the morning when you are going out to your garden to monitor it, you take those traps and you shake them against the side of a bucket that has water and a squirt of dish soap in, and they will fall out. The interesting thing that I learned while I was doing this book and testing these traps is that I also caught thrips in the cardboard traps and the newspaper traps. And so I thought, ooh, an added benefit.
Yeah, I like that. And a lot of people will tune in on that because people do not like earwigs. Let's just put it that way, that for a variety of reasons. They don't look so nice either. You also had I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, but the interesting thing about earwigs is they're also considered, believe it or not, a beneficial insect because they prey on aphids, spider mites, and insect eggs. So, you know, it's a matter of, are they behaving themselves in your garden this year, or are they being bad? If they're being bad, we definitely want to set some traps.
And the other trap was that I saw was the cucumber beetle trap, which
yes.
Looked pretty simple.
It's super simple. So all you need is one of those a yellow plastic drinking cup that's like 16 outside. And what you do is that you attach it to a stake. You use something like a tanglefoot type of a sticky coating on the outside. And on the inside of the cup, you'll take like a little cotton pad and use a couple of drops of clove oil. And that scent attracts the cucumber beetles. They come to the trap, land on the sticky coating, and they can't get off, so they die. And this works really well.
Yeah. Let's take a call from Faith in Waupun next. Hi, Faith.
Yes, I'm calling about blight in tomato plants. I'm wondering what else we can do. We put them in a different spot every year. And we mulch them after we plant them. We cut the bottom leaves off, and we space them about 6 feet apart, but we still get the blight.
Oh. Or do you know if it's early blight or late blight, Faith?
I would say maybe late, I guess.
Yeah, do you deal with that, Susan?
No, we somehow are very fortunate in having minimal tomato diseases here, but I know it in some areas of the country they are just awful. And they're isn't a whole lot you can do. It sounds like you're doing absolutely the right thing, Faith, and you know, and trying to get your tomatoes to produce before they get the blight, and to you know, to get some type of a harvest off of them. But I do not know of any organic products that would prevent them. It's sometimes it's just the cultural conditions, the weather conditions that make it more frequent in certain gardens.
Yeah,
but I think you're doing the right things. I wish I had an easy answer for you.
Yeah. I actually have had people call and say, I used to have blight in my tomatoes, and I've had this good experience as well by planting them in straw bales. That's a whole nother method of gardening, straw bale gardening.
Right.
And those tomatoes seem to have avoided blight, where other tomatoes that they might have had in the ground got it. So
that's interesting.
Yeah, so I'm not sure what else I can tell you, Faith. I think a lot of it has to do with the weather. I mean, that's basically it. You just have to keep rotating, keep the plants far apart like you're doing, and unless you have straw bales you want to try, I would just keep at it. I wish we had a better response or a better answer for you. And just one other thing, you know, the one DIY thing, the raised bed with row cover top that you can flip up, you've got that, how to build one of those in your book, and I loved it. And there are lots of great photos to try and explain it, and all that would be, I think, a little difficult for us today, but I just wanted to give you a shout out for that, because if anybody's considering that, they ought to take a look at your book for sure.
Thank you. So, my husband designed it, because I'm definitely not very good at designing those types of things.
Susan, a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. It was a lot of fun, and it was great to hear the different questions that folks had.
Yeah. Susan Mulvihill, her book is called The Vegetable Garden Pest Handbook, Identify and Solve Common Pest Problems on Edible Plants. So it's great to have her with us. Just a look ahead, Monday, Jesse LeGrew is going to be back to talk about security on your home computer and why you might want to have your own VPN. And I hope you'll join us Tuesday at 1 for the 17th Annual State of the Tribes Address. President John Johnson, senior of Lac des Flambeaux Band of the Lake Superior Chippewa Indians, will be delivering this year's address. That's at 1 o'clock on the Ideas Network or online at WPR.org. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.